Good evening, friends, family, students, faculty, staff, community members, and guests. My name is Rose Levine. I'm a senior here at Mount Holyoke, and on behalf of the Student Coalition for Action and the Mount Holyoke College community, I'd like to welcome you to our campus tonight. The Student Coalition for Action at Mount Holyoke is a progressive student organization committed to making change through action. We're working on a variety of campaigns, everything from fighting for fair labor practices on our campus to the socially responsible investment of our college's endowment. On a night like tonight, when we come together as a community to celebrate the power of local, ordinary people shaping the history of our nation, I am honored to be a part of this organization and this college, and I am even more honored to be able to help bring to you Howard Zinn, a man who inspires us all to action by giving voice to the people's history of the United States.
Thank you, Rose. My name is John Weissman. I'm the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, Branch 46. Thank you. I welcome you tonight on behalf of the coalition partners and the activists, the individual activists in Western Massachusetts Jobs with Justice. J with J is a nationwide coalition founded in 1987 to organize and improve working people's standard of living, fight for job security, protect the right to organize. Jobs with Justice believes at its core that in order to be successful, workers' rights, movements, challenges, efforts have to be part of a larger movement for social and economic justice. To that end, Jobs with Justice has created a nationwide network of 40 local coalitions that connect labor, faith-based groups, community groups, student organizations on workplace and community social justice campaigns. Your coalition, the Western Massachusetts J with J, founded in 1993, is now over 50 organizations, including the Student Coalition for Action. You know how some folks, when they're organizing a fundraiser, they're organizing for their capital campaign? We're organizing for our labor campaign. We will apply your donations that you give us tonight, generously and willingly, to funding staff time and eventually hiring an organizer to help the coalition partners put more people in the streets and influence the decisions that gain more social and economic justice. To get here tonight, we greatly relied on and thanked the Odyssey Bookshop. Yeah. Mount Holyoke College's Students Coalition for Action, Office of Student Programs and History Department, and the wonderfully long list of sponsors and volunteers you'll see in the program. We thank those who will read tonight, directed by Chris Roman. They have donated their time, their effort, their talent, their enthusiasm to help us all celebrate people's history. Most of all, we thank the dynamic duo of Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnove, whose book Voices of a People's History of the United States has been the foundation of performances like this around the country. Imagine going back in time and watching and listening to historic figures, being inspired by them to go forward and to act today and tomorrow. That's history in the hands of Howard Zinn. We are blessed to have him here tonight. He has inspired us not only to perform readings from his book, but to add our own findings from Western Massachusetts. Tonight, we can only skim the surface. We're going to present you with a montage of voices and events, hopefully inspiring all of us to dig deeper, balance it out, satisfy everyone's need to know, and constantly remind ourselves of the long historical path that we are all on together. Please tonight treat this montage as a whole and save your applause until the end.
Okay, with no further ado, it is my great, great honor to welcome Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnove.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. What a great welcome. I'd like to say, we always get such a welcome. No. Western Massachusetts is special, really. And your enthusiasm is infectious. Anthony and I are infected. So we'll do our best. Just a word about the origin of all of this. I guess it starts with Anthony and I and the publisher of Seven Stories Press deciding that what was particularly striking in my book, A People's History of the United States, were those nuggets of quotes from fugitive slaves and rebellious women and labor organizers and pacifists and socialists and anarchists and dissidents of all kinds. And so we decided we would just put together a book just of those voices with as little commentary from us as possible. Something to stand as a counter to those various books of documents which are given to students in schools, have been given for generations. And you know, I remember we were always pointed to, you know, documents of American history. They were always official statements. They were laws passed by Congress, speeches by presidents, decisions of the Supreme Court. We decided we're going to have a book with none of that. We've heard enough from the presidents of the United States. We've heard enough from the Supreme Court and Congress. No, we wanted the voices of people, people who haven't been heard, and in some cases, people who are not obscure, but in some cases, people who are famous, but not for what we found important about them. You know, like Mark Twain, famous for his great novels, but in school, people are not told that Mark Twain was an anti-imperialist who denounced the war in the Philippines, or Helen Keller, whom you will also find in our book, who is known, you know, as this young woman who became famous despite all of these handicaps that she had, presumably, which turned out not to be handicaps for her. But how many people learning about Helen Keller in school learned that she was a socialist, that she walked on picket lines, that she fought against World War I? And we wanted these voices, and starting with Las Casas, starting with Las Casas blowing the whistle on Columbus and coming all the way up to today, to the war today, we wanted to cover this range of American descent and wanted, even though we are going back to the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries, we wanted to make all these voices say something that speaks to our time. Because that's what history is for, not simply to delve into the past and know the past. No, the reason for going into the past is to know the present and to act in the present. And that's what we hope our book will spur people to do. And what you will hear tonight are some of the voices in that book, and we're grateful to all of you here for coming to listen and for the people who put all this together tonight and those who you are going to hear read this evening. Thank you. recent years, we've begun to reconsider that idealized romantic picture of Columbus, maybe spurred on by the fact that Indians have begun to speak up and reclaim their heritage to retell the story. And the main witness who tells us about what Columbus really did when he came to this hemisphere was Bartolomé de las Casas. And here he talks about what he saw, what he experienced.
Su Majestad, todas estas universas e infinitas gentes a todo género crió Dios, las más simples, sin maldades ni dobleces, más humildes, más pacientes, más pacíficas e quietas, sin rencillas ni bullicios, no rijosos, no querulosos, sin rencores, sin odios, sin desear venganzas que hay en el mundo. Your Majesty, these people are by nature the most humble, peaceable, holding no grudges, free from embroilments, neither excitable nor quarrelsome. These people are the most devoid of rancors, hatred, or desire for vengeance of any people in the world. Yet, into these peaceful people, there came some Spaniards who immediately behaved like ravening wild beasts, wolves, tigers, or lions that had been starved for many days. And Spaniards have behaved in no other way during the past 40 years, down to the present time. For they are still acting like ravening beasts, killing, terrorizing, afflicting, torturing, and destroying the native peoples, doing all this with the strangest and most varied new methods of cruelty never seen or heard before. And to such a degree that this island of Hispaniola, once so populous, having a population that I estimated to be more than 3 million, has now a population of barely 200 persons. Your Majesty, I implore you, do not license nor permit this so-called conquest, invented by tyrants, since if permitted, they will continue to perpetrate on these peaceful, humble, and gentle native peoples who do not offend anybody, acts that are iniquitous, tyrannical, and condemned, detested, and accursed by all laws, natural, divine, and human.
1676, the Jesuit missionary Chrétien Leclerc attempted to convince the Mi'kmaq Indian people to build wooden houses, convert to Christianity, and adopt European ways of life. A Miramichi Mi'kmaq sachem responded to Leclerc's entreaties as follows.
If France is, as you tell us, heaven on earth, why did you leave it in the first place? Why abandon wives, children, relatives, and friends to risk your lives and property in a dangerous sea voyage? Only to come here, the place you keep telling us is the most barbarous, poor, and unfortunate in the world. The very fact that you bother at all convinces us of the opposite. Certainly, we have no wish to visit your France when, in your own experience, those who are native there must leave it every year in order to enrich themselves on our shores. We could only do poorly in such an impoverished country. Indeed, you must be incomparably poorer than the Mi'kmaqs, since you will give anything to get scraps of fur and miserable, worn-out beaver clothing, which are no longer of any use to us. And since you consider cod fishery as a sufficient source of income, frankly, we Mi'kmaqs pity you. Before you came here, the Mi'kmaq people lived longer than they do now. if we no longer have wise elders in our midst who are 100 years old or more, it is only because we are gradually adopting too much of your European way of life. There is no Micmac who does not consider himself infinitely happier and more powerful than the French. We are 1,000 times freer and more content in our woods and in our wigwams than we would be in the palaces and at the tables of the greatest kings on earth.
During the early 1700s, many of the Pocumtuck and Nonotuck, the original native inhabitants of present-day Deerfield, Hadley, Northampton, moved north to seek shelter with the Abenaki. The Massachusetts colonial leaders negotiated numerous treaties, but consistently failed to respect Abenaki territorial boundaries. In July 1752, the governor of Massachusetts sent Captain Phineas Stevens to a council meeting to ask why the Abenaki persisted in attacking English towns in the Connecticut River Valley. The sachem Atuenato explained,
"Brothers, we hear on all sides that the governor and Bostonians say that the Abenakis are bad people. 'Tis in vain that we are taxed with having a bad heart. It is you, brother, that always attack us. Your mouth is of sugar, but your heart of gall. In truth, the moment you begin, we are on our guard. Brothers, we tell you, we seek not war. We ask nothing better than to be quiet, and it depends only on you, brothers, to have peace with us. We have not yet sold the lands we inhabit. We wish to keep possession of them. Our elders have been willing to tolerate you on the seaboard. As that has been decided, we wish it to be so. But we will not cede one single inch of lands we inhabit beyond what has been decided formally by our fathers. You can have the sea for your share. From the place where you reside, you can trade with us there. But we expressly forbid you to kill a single beaver, to take a single stick of timber on the lands we inhabit. If you want timber, we will sell you some. But you shall not take it without our permission. We acknowledge no other boundaries of yours other than your settlements whereon you have built. And we will not, under any pretext whatsoever, that you pass beyond them. The lands we possess have been given us by the Master of Life. We acknowledge to hold only from him."
In the year 1619, the first blacks were brought by force to serve the white colonists of Virginia. But for the next 200 years, slavery was not confined to the South. The first African slaves arrived in Boston in 1638, and Massachusetts was the first American colony to recognize slavery as a legal institution. In 1777, during the colonists' war for independence from British domination, a group of slaves sent this petition to the Massachusetts legislature.
"The petition of a great number of Negroes who were detained in a state of slavery in the bowels of a free and Christian country, humbly showing
that your petitioners apprehend that they have been, in common with all other men, a natural and unalienable right to that freedom which the great parent of the universe has bestowed equally on all mankind,
which they have never forfeited by any compact or agreement whatever, but were unjustly dragged from a populous, pleasant, and plentiful country and brought hither to be sold like beasts of burden and condemned to slavery for life.
Among a people professing the mild religion of Jesus.
A people not insensible to the sweets of freedom.
Nor without the spirit to resent the unjust endeavors of those who seek to reduce those into a state of bondage and subjection.
Every every principle from which America has acted in her course of unhappy difficulties with Great Britain pleads stronger than 1,000 arguments in favor of your petitioners.
They therefore humbly beseech your honors to cause an act of the legislature to be passed whereby they may be restored to the enjoyment of that freedom which is the natural right of all men.
Massachusetts was the first state to abolish slavery in 1783, 6 years after that petition was delivered to the legislature. 3 years after that, in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War, another group of aggrieved Massachusetts residents was heard from.
The American Revolution was not, as the orthodox histories would have it, the revolt of a unified people. The colonies were torn apart by class conflict in the hundred years before the Revolution. After the war, small farmers, many of them veterans of the war, found themselves so heavily taxed they could not meet their payments. In 1786, thousands of farmers in western Massachusetts surrounded the courthouses where their farms were being auctioned off to pay their taxes and refused to allow the courts to proceed. This was an armed revolt named after one of its leaders, Daniel Shays of Pelham, a Revolutionary Army captain. These are the words of one of the participants in Shays' rebellion, Plow Jogger.
I have labored hard all my days and fared hard. I have been greatly abused. I have been obliged to do more than my part in the war. I've been loaded with class rates and town rates and province rates and continental rates and all rates. I've been pulled and hauled by sheriffs and constables and collectors and had my cattle sold for less than they were worth. I have been obliged to pay, and nobody will pay me. I have lost a great deal by this man and that man and the other man, and I think the great men are going to get all we have. I think it's time for us to rise and put a stop to it and have no more courts, nor sheriffs, nor collectors, nor lawyers. And I know that we are the biggest party. Let them say what they will. We have come to relieve the distresses of the people. There will be no court until they have redress of their grievances.
Henry Knox, the Revolutionary Artillery Commander who became the first U.S. Secretary of War, wrote to George Washington to warn him about the goals of the Massachusetts rebels.
They feel at once their own poverty compared with the opulent. Their creed is that the property of the United States has been protected from the confiscations of Britain by the joint exertions of all, and therefore ought to be the common property of all.
Eventually, Shays' rebellion was crushed, but it put a scare into the Founding Fathers. When they met in 1787 to create a constitution, they made sure to set up a government strong enough to put down popular rebellion.
Boston capitalists began building textile mills in Lowell in the early 19th century, and they recruited young women from rural New England as their labor force. These women went to work at the age of 12 and often died by the age of 25. The capitalists assumed that these girls would be docile and easily managed. But the young women in the Lowell Mills formed reading circles, organized to demand their rights as laborers and as women, agitated for better workplace conditions. Harriet Hanson Robinson, who started work in the mills when she was only 10 years old, recounts her experience in the 1836 strike.
I worked in a lower room where I had heard the proposed strike fully, if not vehemently, discussed. I'd been an ardent listener of what was said against the attempt of oppression on the part of the corporation, and naturally I took sides with the strikers. When the day came when the girls were to turn out, those in the upper room started first, and so many of them left that our mill was at once shut down. Then, when the girls in my room stood irresolute, uncertain what to do, asking each other, would you or should we turn out? and not one of them having the courage to lead off, I, who had begun to think that they would not go out after all their talk, became impatient and started on ahead, saying with the childish bravado, I don't care what you do. I am going to turn out, whether anyone else does or not. And I marched out and was followed by the others. As I looked back at that long line that followed me, I was more proud than I have ever been since at any success I may have achieved.
Lydia Maria Child sacrificed her position as one of the most popular American women writers to the cause of immediate abolition of slavery. Her self-help guide, The Frugal Housewife, was a huge bestseller. But when she published a groundbreaking anti-slavery tract, sales dried up and she lost her privileges as one of the only two women allowed to use the library at the Boston Athenaeum. She and her husband lived in Northampton and Florence from 1838 to 1841. This was a period of great strain in the abolitionist movement between those who advocated women's rights, nonviolence, and moral suasion, and the upholders of quote-unquote traditional values. In letters to fellow women activists written in her room in what is now Duckett House at Smith College, Child vented her frustrations with the abolitionist movement.
The state of abolition here seems to me lifeless enough. Orthodoxy has dressed most of the community in her straitlaced garments. There is groaning and psalm singing and praying and preaching and reverence for the divine ambassadors of Christ and savings of souls, etc., more than enough. But of genuine love for the neighbor as a child of one common father, the manifestations seem to be of the smallest. Our room is within call of a rich former slave auctioneer who prays so loud that Mr. Child has to strike up his accordion to drown out sounds so discordant to our feelings. Whether the Lord hears him or not, I cannot tell, but he takes care that the neighborhood shall. I have felt half disposed to repeat the advice of the heathen philosopher, don't pray so loud. It's safer for you not to let the gods know where you are. I have never been so discouraged about abolition as since we came to this iron-bound valley of the Connecticut. I have ceased to believe that public opinion will ever be sincerely reformed on the question till long after emancipation has taken place. I mean that for generations to come, there will be a very large minority hostile to the claims of colored people.
John Brown, more than any other white American, devoted his life and finally sacrificed it to abolish slavery. In 1859, his plan to capture the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, and fuel a slave insurgency throughout the South failed. Brown was hanged. Frederick Douglass, the former slave who became the brilliant and powerful leader of the anti-slavery movement, once said, John Brown began the war that ended slavery and made this a free republic. Douglass recalled how the two men met in 1847 when Brown was a merchant in Springfield.
I chanced to spend a night and a day under the roof of a man whose character and conversation and whose objects and aims in life made a very deep impression upon my mind and heart.
Slaveholders have forfeited their right to live. Slaves have the right to gain their liberty in any way they can. Moral suasion will never liberate the slave. Political action will never abolish the system. I have long had a plan which could accomplish this end. That is why I have invited you to my house.
His plan had much to commend him. It did not, as some suppose, contemplate a general rising among the slaves and a general slaughter of the slave masters. He contemplated creating an armed force which should act in the very heart of the South.
The object is, first of all, to destroy the money value of slave property and that can only be done by rendering such property insecure. My plan, then, is to take at first about 25 picked men and begin on a small scale, supply them with arms and ammunition, post them in squads of five on a line of 25 miles in the mountains, the most persuasive and judicious of whom shall go down to the fields from time to time as opportunity offers, and induce the slaves to join them, seeking and selecting the most restless and daring. With care and enterprise, I could soon gather a force of 100 hardy men. When these are properly drilled, and each man had found the place for which he was best suited, we will run off the slaves in large numbers, retain the brave and strong ones in the mountains, and send the weak and timid to the north by the Underground Railroad.
But the effect will be only to make the slaveholders sell their slaves further south.
That will be first what I want to do. Then I would follow them up. If we could drive slavery out of one county, it would be a great gain. It would weaken the system throughout the state.
We might convert the slaveholders.
That could never be. I know their proud hearts. They will never be induced to give up their slaves until they feel a big stick about their heads.
From this night, I became less hopeful of slavery's peaceful abolition. Speaking at an anti-slave convention in Salem, Ohio, I expressed this apprehension that slavery could only be destroyed by bloodshed, when I was suddenly and sharply interrupted by my good old friend, Sojourner Truth.
Frederick, is God dead?
No. And because God is not dead, slavery can only end in blood. My sister was shocked, but she too became an advocate of the sword when the war for the maintenance of the Union was declared.
It was early in the morning. It was early in the morning. It was early in the morning, just at the break of day. Let me tell you a few things about the folks in Northampton. You might know about my speeches from here to high heaven, about the way I met presidents, about me fixing the wagon of those men in Washington, D.C., who wouldn't let this tired old woman ride their streetcars, or about telling men to give women their rights, and oh, about paying slaves back for their labor. I'm still petitioning the government for that, and I won't stop. I'm not done with my life, so I can't tell you all about it. But I don't know if these grander times would have happened if I hadn't hiked up the hill from the dusty downtown of Northampton back in 1843. My daughters, Sophia and Elizabeth, soon joined me and lived with the rest of us in the silk factory. Now picture black people living with white people, the high, the low, the rich, and the poor. And when it came time to debate, every voice was equal. It was wonderful. I can't read or write, but I wrote a book. The book put me into a place to do something that once was beyond imagining. I bought a house in Northampton. A house. Who would have thought that I could buy a house? And right across from a cemetery, no fussing from my neighbors. All stiff as planks. The Lord could have sent a lightning bolt right down through me, and I would have been satisfied, because nothing was sweeter. It was me and my daughters, grown as they were, and my fiery grandson, living together in a house I owned. My head is filled with light, and my feet cannot touch the ground.
One reaction to the poverty and violence of capitalism in the 19th century was to dream of a different kind of world. Edward Bellamy's novel, Looking Back, imagined a man waking up in the year 2000 in a socialist America based on equality and justice. Published in 1887, it was second only to Karl Marx's Capital as the most influential book of the age. Bellamy, a newspaperman from Chicopee Falls, enjoyed writing in parables. Chapter 1 of Looking Backward contains the parable of the coach.
By way of attempting to give the reader some general impression of the way people lived together in those days, and especially of the relations of the rich and poor to one another, perhaps I cannot do better than to compare society as it then was to a prodigious coach which the masses of humanity were harnessed to and dragged toilsomely along a very hilly and sandy road. The driver was hunger and permitted no lagging, though the pace was necessarily very slow. Despite the difficulty of drawing the coach at all along so hard a road, the top was covered with passengers who never got down, even at the steepest ascents. Those seats on top were very breezy, comfortable, well up out of the dust. Their occupants could enjoy the scenery at their leisure or critically discuss the merits of the straining team. Naturally, such places were in great demand, and the competition for them was keen, everyone seeking, as the first end in life, to secure a seat on the coach for himself and leave it to his child after him. Commiseration was frequently expressed by those who rode and for those who had to pull the coach, especially when the vehicle came to a bad place in the road, as it was constantly doing, or to a particularly steep hill. At such times, the passengers would call down encouragingly to the toilers of the rope, exhorting them to patience and holding out hopes of possible compensation in another world for the hardness of their lot, while others contributed to buy salves and liniments for the crippled and injured.
The first significant labor federation in America was the Knights of Labor, which reached its peak in the late 19th century. Taking as their motto, "An injury to one is an injury to all," the Knights organized African Americans, women, unskilled laborers, all on an equal basis, opening their ranks to all working people over the age of 16, except bankers, lawyers, and gamblers. Around 1890, they rewrote the gospel song, "Pull the Fort," and started singing.
Money from our deepest times. Now
black sociologist, activist, socialist, W.B. Du Bois, was born and raised in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. In The Souls of Black Folk, he stated prophetically that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line.
Between me and the other world, there is ever an unasked question, unasked by some through feelings of delicacy, by others through the difficulty of rightly framing it. All, nevertheless, flutter around it. Instead of saying directly,
"How does it feel to be a problem?"
they say,
"I know an excellent colored man in my town."
Or,
"I fought at Mechanicsville."
Or,
"Do not these southern outrages make your blood boil?"
At these I smile, or am interested, or reduce the boiling to a shimmer, as the occasion may require. To the real question, how does it feel to be a problem? I seldom answer the word. And yet, being a problem is a strange experience. The Negro is a sort of seventh son, born with a veil and gifted with second sight in this American world, a world which heals him no self-consciousness, but only lets him see himself through the revelation of the other world. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt or pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. The history of the American Negro is the history of the strife, this longing to merge his double self into a better and truer self. In this merging, he wishes neither of the older selves to be lost. He does not wish to Africanize America, for America has too much to teach the world and Africa. He does not wish to bleach his Negro blood in a flood of white Americanism. He simply wishes to make it possible for a man to be both a Negro and an American.
The nations of Europe went to war in 1914. In the United States, which had not yet entered the war, class conflict was intense. In the summer of 1916, during a Preparedness Day parade in San Francisco, a bomb exploded, killing 9 people. Tom Mooney, a labor organizer, and Warren Billings, a shoe worker, were framed by business and government interests and convicted. They spent 23 years in prison before being pardoned. Mooney was raised in Holyoke. His father, an Indiana coal miner and one of the first organizers of the Knights of Labor, died at 36 from tuberculosis when Tom was only 10 years old. His mother became a rag sorter in a Holyoke paper mill. Tom helped her as a rag picker in the paper mill by day and as a laundry worker by night.
I suppose the urge to serve the labor movement was born in me.
From prison in 1934, Mooney recounted that his lifelong commitment to unionism started with an experience in a Holyoke factory.
I served my apprenticeship as a core maker in the Dean Steam Pump Company, where the Iron Molders Union had a closed shop. The core makers had an open shop, working for anything they could get. The core makers union was weak, numerically and otherwise. The molders union and the core makers union acted separately, and in strikes, each union worked with scabs of the opposite craft. When I completed my apprenticeship and joined the core makers, I was receiving $1 a day for 10 hours' work. I immediately asked for the standard scale of 225. The boss said to me, "Well, if you increase the amount of work you're doing at present, I'll raise you to $1.80 a day." But I was turning out the same amount and brand of work that those making 225 were turning out. I said nothing. Went back to work to my bench, determined not to increase my output. In August of 2002, I received my first lesson in unionism when the International Core Makers Union Convention in Cleveland voted for the solidarity of amalgamation with the Iron Molders Union. Since that time, I have been a continuous, active, good standing member of the International Molders Union, traveling across the country from coast to coast, fighting for better shop and job conditions.
Emma Goldman, a Lithuanian immigrant, was an anarchist and feminist, orator, agitator, organizer. She was jailed many times for her inflammatory speeches. She was imprisoned during World War I for agitating against the draft, then deported after the war. Goldman spoke out many times against war-making and imperialism. In a speech in San Francisco in 1908, she condemned patriotism as
a menace to liberty. What is patriotism? Is it the love of one's birthplace, the place of childhood's recollections and hopes and dreams and aspirations? Leo Tolstoy, the greatest anti-patriot of our time, defines patriotism as the principle that will justify the training of wholesale murderers, a trade that requires better equipment for the exercise of man-killing than making of such necessities of life as shoes, clothing, and houses. Indeed, conceit, arrogance, and egotism are the essentials of patriotism. Let me illustrate. Patriotism assumes that our globe is divided into little spots, each one surrounded by an iron gate. Those born on some particular spot consider themselves better, nobler, grander, more intelligent than the living beings inhabiting the other spots. It therefore stands to reason, and it is their duty to fight, kill, and die in the attempt to impose their superiority. We Americans, we claim to be a peace-loving people, yet we go into spasms of joy over the possibility of projecting dynamite bombs from flying machines upon helpless citizens. Our hearts swell with pride at the thought that America is becoming the most powerful nation on the earth, and that it will eventually plant her iron foot on the necks of all the other nations in the world. Such is the logic of patriotism. But thinking men and women all over the globe are beginning to realize that patriotism is too narrow and limited a conception to meet the necessities of our time. There is an international feeling of solidarity among the oppressed nations of the world, a solidarity which fears not foreign invasion, because it is bringing all the workers to the point when they will say to their masters, "Go and do your own killing. We have done it long enough for you."